From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
60% of the population which are...
Operation Mass Appeal. Former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter reveals a covert British intelligence disinformation campaign on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. We'll also talk about the women of Iraq.
Under control, and I think 60% of the population, which are the women now, will not have a say for the future of Iraq. And the two women who are left in the governing council are under veil, which gives a message to all women in Iraq. This is the submissive role that we expect for you in this coming era.
And here in this country, as the mad cow scare spreads to 8 states, we'll hear from a scientist who helped develop the first unobtrusive test for mad cow disease. The test has been approved in Britain, but the USDA has refused to use it here. We'll also be joined by John Stauber, author of Mad Cow USA. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, a member of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council, Iyad Alawi, has told the London-based newspaper Al-Hayat that Saddam Hussein's trial might be held in secret. He was concerned about the, quote, possibility he will mention the names of states and the names of persons to whom he has given bribes and wealth. We don't want him to mention all that on television. Iyad Alawi continued, there are lots of existing documents and we don't want to worsen Iraq's relations with others. Alawi also said Saddam Hussein deposited as much as $40 billion in foreign accounts under fictitious company names around the world. The New York Times cites an unnamed U.S. official, though, saying the report is, quote, completely wrong. Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge ordered foreign airlines to place armed air marshals on some flights to and from the United States. Anticipating the announcement, Britain began deploying armed marshals on flights over the weekend. While the U.S. has given private U.S. airlines hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to cover new security costs, no aid is being given to the foreign airlines to pay for the marshals. Airlines that refuse to comply will be barred from landing in the United States. The International Air Transport Association, which represents international airlines, came out against Tom Ridge's order. An Israeli security expert told USA Today, quote, no country has ever tried to impose on other countries any measures of aviation security. Meanwhile, the FBI has issued a warning to police to be on the lookout for people carrying copies of the World Almanac because it, quote, may point to possible terrorist planning. The Financial Times is reporting that U.S. oil companies are expected to begin negotiations with Libya over the nation's oil reserves early in the new year. Washington's expected to lift the trade sanctions that have been in place since 1986. Libya has about 40,000 million barrels of oil reserves, about one-eighth of the reserves of Saudi Arabia. Companies expected to seek contracts include ConocoPhillips, Marathon Oil, Occidental Petroleum, ExxonMobil, and Hess. Meanwhile, the head of the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohamed El-Baradei, is in Libya examining the nation's nuclear sites. He said the country's nuclear program was at a very early stage, contradicting reports out of Washington and London. In Iran, the search for survivors in last week's devastating earthquake continues. At least 28,000 people have died. Officials now say the death toll may top 50,000. On Monday, rescue workers found a 6-month baby named Nassim alive in the arms of her dead mother. Iran's most powerful leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, also visited the site of the earthquake and vowed to rebuild the ancient city of Bam. Meanwhile, the European insurance company Munich Re is reporting that natural disasters killed nearly five times as many people in 2003 as last year. The United States now believes the cow infected with mad cow disease was likely infected in 1997 before safety bans were enacted. Meanwhile, the Canadian government's conducting DNA tests to determine if the infected cow was born in Alberta as claimed by the United States. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that federal investigators now believe at least 81 cattle in the U.S. may have been exposed to mad cow disease. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to place its first ban today on a dietary supplement. The substance, ephedra, has long been tied to heart problems and strokes. The U.S. military has dropped charges against Sergeant George Parigny, who was accused of cowardice after he suffered a panic attack after seeing a dead Iraqi body. Howard Dean's campaign is reporting that the former Vermont governor raised $14 million in fourth quarter fundraising, bringing his annual total to about $40 million, breaking a new Democratic Party record. President Bush, who's running unopposed for his party's nomination, has raised at least $110 million to date. In the Central African country of Burundi, the Vatican's ambassador to the country was shot dead on Monday. The Los Angeles Times is reporting that the nation's official unemployment rate of 5.9% fails to include nearly 5 million part-time workers who can't find full-time work and 1.5 million people who have given up looking for a job. If these figures were calculated into the equation, the nation's unemployment rate would jump to 9.7%. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President George Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair's justification for the invasion of Iraq has run up against what appears to be unintended scrutiny from an unlikely source, Paul Bremer, head of the occupation forces in Iraq. In an interview with London's ITV1, Bremer dismissed Blair's allegation that British and American weapons hunters had unearthed massive evidence of a huge system of clandestine laboratories in Iraq. The supposed danger from Saddam Hussein's alleged WMD was central to the case for war in Iraq. Despite months of work, the Iraq Survey Group, headed by David Kaye, has all but given up hope of finding them. Blair has remained undaunted, insisting that the evidence would eventually turn up, and told British troops in his Christmas message that the information on laboratories showed Saddam had attempted to conceal weapons. But when the claim was put to Bremer, he said it was not true. unaware that had been made by Mr. Blair, the allegation. The American proconsul said it sounded like a red herring put about by someone opposed to military action to undermine the coalition. He said, quote, "I don't know where those words come from, but that is not what David Kaye has said." Bremer went on to say, "I have read his report, so I don't know who said that. It sounds like someone who doesn't agree with the policy sets up a red herring, then knocks it down." But when the interviewer told Bremer the statement was actually made by the British Prime Minister, he changed his tune, saying, quote, "There's actually a lot of evidence that had been made public," adding that the group had found, quote, "clear evidence of biological and chemical programs ongoing and clear evidence of violation of UN Security Council resolutions relating to rockets." This comes amid allegations from a former chief UN weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, that MI6, the British intelligence agency, ran a campaign designed to exaggerate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Ritter told reporters in the British House of Commons that he was personally involved with Operation Mass Appeal between the summer of 1997 until August 1998, when he resigned from the UN. Ritter said the MI6 operation was designed to shake up public opinion by passing dubious intelligence on to Iraq and to the media. A spokesperson for MI6 said the allegations were unfounded. Scott Ritter joins us now, the former UN weapons inspector. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, can you talk about what you were doing with the British spy agency?
Well, first of all, let's clarify a couple things. A, it's not an allegation. The British government did say it was unfounded when I first came forward with the specifics of Operation Mass Appeal. But according to the Sunday Times this past weekend, the British government has now changed its tune and acknowledged that indeed there was Operation Mass Appeal, and that it was an MI6 operation, and that it was designed to help shape public opinion. So let's just understand from the start that what we're talking about is not a mere allegation. It's a statement of fact. Why was I involved with the British intelligence service? Look, I ran intelligence operations for the United Nations in regards to the disarmament of Iraq. That was my job. Part of this job in 1997, 1998 took on a propaganda aspect, given the fact that we had launched a series of controversial and confrontational inspections in Iraq, which, although successful from a disarmament standpoint in exposing aspects of the Iraqi account which were not accurate, were causing problems for the United Nations in the Security Council. The Security Council as a whole was not backing these tactics that we were using. They were becoming more and more sympathetic to the Iraqi angle, which was that the inspectors were simply coming into Iraq and deliberately causing trouble, serving the purposes of the unilateral objectives, policy objectives of the United States and Great Britain to target Saddam Hussein, not to target weapons of mass destruction, etc. We made a decision, we being Richard Butler, the executive chairman who ran UNSCOM, and his senior staff members, of which I was one, that we needed to clean up our public our public image. And we did a number of things. For instance, in the fall and winter of 1997, we worked with CNN to put together a very high-profile one-hour special on CNN about the weapons inspectors, about the Iraqi concealment program, etc. This is something that caused the Iraqis and their Security Council allies great consternation. They condemned UNSCOM for getting involved in, this kind of media game. Of course, it was the same media game the Iraqis were playing and, taking journalists on guided tours of areas in Iraq that weapons inspectors were trying to gain access to, saying these had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. I was approached by the British Intelligence Service, which I had a long relationship with of an official nature, to see if there was any information in the archives of UNSCOM that could be handed to the British so that they could, in turn, work it over, determine its veracity, and then seek to plant it in media outlets around the world in an effort to try and shape the public opinion of those countries, and then indirectly through, you know, for instance, a report showing up in the Polish press, shape public opinion in Great Britain and the United States. I went to Richard Butler with the request from the British. He said that he supported this, and we initiated a cooperation that was very short-lived. The British came to me in, not in the summer of 97, but December 1997. The first reports were passed to the British sometime in February of 98. There was a detailed planning meeting in June of 1998, and I resigned in August 1998. So it wasn't as though UNSCOM's participation in this was significant. This is an operation, Operation Mass Appeal, that had been going on prior to UNSCOM being asked to be the source of particular data. And it's an operation that continued after my resignation.
We're talking to Scott Ritter, who's a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, who says that in 1997, 1998, he worked with the MI6 with Operation Mass Appeal. A spokesperson speaking on behalf of the British spy agency told BBC News Online, the allegation that Ritter was using MI6 material is unfounded. Your response to that?
Well, it's an absurd and extreme. The allegation that I was using MI6 material, first of all, what allegation that I was using MI6? I think in regards to Mass Appeal, the statement of fact that I put forward is that UNSCOM provided data to MI6, which then MI6 used in the press. And that's no longer unfounded. The British government has acknowledged this. They have acknowledged the existence of Operation Mass Appeal and its role in you know, serving as a conduit of propaganda information to the media. So, you know, that is, I believe, what we're talking about here. The British government needs to be careful here, because remember, there was an inquiry by Lord Hutton into the death of David Kelly, the former British scientist who tragically took his own life after he was exposed by the British government as a source of information to the BBC. During this inquiry, MI6 was called to testify, and MI6 stated on record that it played no role in shaping public opinion, that all it did is provide, you know, intelligence assessment to the British government, and that that was all its job was collecting intelligence data and then providing assessments on this data and giving it to the British government. Now, you know, after being summoned to testify under oath before an official committee, the British government has to acknowledge that wait a minute, there was an intelligence operation run by MI6, which did involve, you know, passing intelligence to media outlets for propaganda purposes. The revelation of Mass Appeal has totally contradicted sworn testimony of British intelligence services, and this should cause great consternation not only for Lord Hutton and his inquiry, which it appears now they were misled or lied to, but also the British Parliament, which needs to take a closer look, in my opinion, at how public opinion was shaped by the British government in regards to, you know, alleged threats coming from Iraq in the form of weapons of mass destruction. Let's keep this all in focus by noting that Tony Blair said that there were massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. His government published a dossier which backed up these unfounded allegations, and now we are almost 10 months into an occupation of Iraq, and no such weaponry has been found. That should be everyone's focus. Where are the weapons? Why did the British government say these weapons existed before the war? And if the British government didn't have the data necessary to sustain these allegations, were they lying when they made their assessments, or were they simply manipulating the public? And this is something that should be looked into. And, you know, the existence of operations like Mass Appeal, run by British intelligence services designed to manipulate public opinion, should be examined in great detail.
Scott Ritter, why didn't you say this before the invasion?
Well, before the invasion, I've said many things. I've gone on record as saying that the British government manipulated data. I've gone on record challenging the assessments of the British government and the United States government. I've said straight up that they don't have this data to back up these allegations. I've said straight up that they are misinforming the public, misrepresenting data. I've said straight up that their intelligence services cannot back up the claims being made. What I didn't say was Operation Mass Appeal. You know, should I have said that before? Look, Amy, I'm sitting on a wealth of data. You could interview me for a year, and I would come up with something new and dramatic every time you talked to me. Why didn't I pick that particular piece of data? Which piece of data do you want me to pick out of my 7-year experience as a weapons inspector, which was very detailed and involved, multifaceted operations around the world? I did mention Mass Appeal to journalists in the spring of 2003, the summer of 2003, and some journalists chose not to do anything with it. Other journalists, like Seymour Hersh, ran major articles. Seymour Hersh ran an article in The New Yorker in which, although he didn't mention Operation Mass Appeal by name, he did talk about MI6's Information Operations Division and how they passed information to the media. He talked about a similar operation undertaken by the CIA, but nobody seemed to take notice. So when I'm at the House of Commons in November of this year, and I'm meeting with British parliamentarians, and it becomes clear that the British parliamentarians are willing to rest on the laurels of the Hutton Report, that they were comfortable with, you know, the statements made by MI6 and British intelligence about their role with the media, I said, oh, look, it's time you guys dig a little bit deeper. I'm going to give you some assistance by sharing this data with you. And I gave them the name of the operation, I gave them the name of the intelligence service, and I gave them the name of the people involved. I gave the name of the people involved off the record because they are serving intelligence officers. The publication of their names would represent a threat to them and their families. So hopefully no one's going to ever mention those names. But by providing those names to specific sources, they were able to pin down, as the Sunday Times did this past weekend, the British government catch them in a lie and compel them to acknowledge the existence of Mass Appeal.
Can you give specific examples of disinformation that you gave to the MI6?
First of all, I didn't give disinformation to MI6. I provided, as I clearly stated, intelligence data that was unverifiable. I provided intelligence data that was unactionable. UNSCOM had a number of files of data pertaining to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program that lacked the specificity necessary for us to take action. So these files were sitting in our cabinet doing nothing, gathering dust. And what the British wanted were these files to be transferred to them so that they could then work these files over using their own information, seeing if they could determine the veracity of this information, and then make, you know, an effort if the information was accurate, and this is according to the agreement that we had, if this information was accurate, they would then seek to plant it in the media abroad. So it wasn't a disinformation campaign that I was involved in. It was a propaganda campaign, one that we felt was politically necessary given the political events of 1997-1998.
And what specifically was planted?
And again, this is what I've told the British, and I'll say it right now. What needs to happen isn't for Scott Ritter to pull out one or two examples and give it to you or anyone else. What needs to happen, happened. The British government acknowledged now that their intelligence service, their secret intelligence service, was involved, contrary to the public statements of the MI6 chief to Lord Hinton's inquiry, involved in a propaganda campaign designed to shape public opinion. So what needs to happen is, rather than me continue to snipe from the edge, now that the British government has acknowledged this, there must be an inquiry in which MI6 is required to put all of its files. Don't ask me what MI6 was doing. Ask MI6. Demand that these files be put before the British Parliament. Demand that the people understand the totality of this propaganda campaign. Was this propaganda campaign disinformation? Did the British intelligence service deliberately plant data which they knew was unsustainable, unverifiable, data which they couldn't back up with anything else. This is the key of the question, not to come back to the man who's trying to do his best to expose the truth by saying, all right, give us specific examples. I can do that, and I've told the British Parliament that if you want to have an inquiry and call me before you, I will testify under oath about this. But right now, the pressure should be put on the British government to provide the data, not on other individuals.
Looking at the Sunday Times of London, it says that Mr. Ritter said he obtained approval to cooperate with Richard Butler, then executive chair of the UN Special Commission on Iraq Disarmament. Mr. Butler, now governor of Tasmania, said yesterday he'd no recollection of this. He said he would not have approved any operations falling outside his disarmament mandate. Quote, we have a choice with respect to Scott Ritter, Butler said. Either he was misleading me when he worked for me, or he's chosen to mislead the public subsequently. He goes on to say, he robustly advised me that Iraq retained unaccounted for WMDs. I think his advice then was correct. Your response?
Well, I mean, if you compare my public statements with Richard Butler's public statements in regards to Iraq weapons of mass destruction programs, I think I have a very good track record. In fact, it's about 100% in terms of being accurate. I don't make anything up. Every time I say something, it's a statement of fact, and you can go to the bank with it. Richard Butler, on the other hand, has been publicly contradicted on any number of occasions about his assessments and about his statements. This is a man who testified before the United States Congress and told them that these weapons existed, that he knew they existed. I called him on this on television, on CNN. I called him a liar in front of everybody. I said, you're lying. You cannot make that statement of certainty. I never once told him that Iraq retained unaccounted-for weaponry. I told him, and it's a matter of record in the United Nations, that we cannot account for all of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs and related weaponry. Therefore, we must investigate them as if Iraq was retaining them, that we cannot treat this as a light subject. Our job is complete disarmament. If we have unaccounted-for material, we must pursue it and pursue it aggressively. This was my my advice to Richard Butler. In December of 1997, I approached Richard Butler about this issue of mass appeal. The British government, through their station chief, the MI6 station chief in New York, had requested that we do not put this in writing. So I went to Richard Butler and sought verbal permission. Richard Butler gave me this verbal permission. Richard Butler knows that this meeting took place in December 1998. Richard Butler knows that there are minutes of meetings that we attended together in London in the first meeting took place in December 1997. In May of 1998, we attended formal meetings in London in which this issue was raised by the British government in front of Richard Butler and myself, and Richard Butler again concurred with UNSCOM's participation. So, you know, I can't say that Richard Butler's lying. He says he has no recollection of this. Maybe what I've just told you, once he hears it or reads of it, will get his brain to dig deeper, and suddenly he'll recall that this, in fact, is accurate. I've been very accurate about everything I've said in regards to weapons of mass destruction. I stand by everything I've ever said, and you know, I think it's Richard Butler that is the one that the media should start looking at askance whenever he opens his mouth about, you know, his involvement in the disarmament effort, because it's clearly he is part of the problem. He is somebody who you know, didn't run a very effective ship when he was the executive chairman. He's somebody who stated with absolute certainty that these weapons existed. I've never said that. I've said that we had a job to do, a disarmament task to do, and we needed to finish that job. We needed to account for all of their weaponry. He took it a step further, saying that Iraq retained this and that he had evidence of this retention. And his statements clearly were cherry-picked by British and American political authorities to help sustain their own allegations of the existence of a massive stockpile of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that helped shape congressional opinion and public opinion here in the United States and parliamentary opinion and public opinion in Great Britain to support a war that we now know was fought under false premise.
Scott Ritter, I want to thank you for joining us. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now. When we come back, we'll look at Mad Cow in the USA.
changed. Our kids are getting worse. They won't obey their parents. They just wanna fart and curse. Should we blame the government or blame society? Or should we blame the images on TV? Now, blame Canada! Blame Canada! It seems that everything's gone wrong since Canada came along. Blame Canada! Blame Canada! We need to form a full assault. Don't blame yourself for your son Stan. He saw that darn cartoon and now he's off to join the Klan. And my boy Eric once had my picture on his shelf, but now when he sees me he tells me to myself. Blame Canada, blame Canada. Because when Canada is gone, there'll be no more Celine Dion. Blame Canada, blame Canada. They're not even a real country anyway. Kenny could have been a doctor or a lawyer, rich and true. Instead he burned up like a piggy on the barbecue. Should we blame the nurses? Should we blame the fire? The doctors who allowed him to expire? Heck no! Blame Canada! Blame Canada! With all their hockey hullabaloo and that bitch Anne Murray too. Blame Canada! Blame Canada! All I can say is I give all this Canada's fault. Everybody! Trudeau's friendly side.
Robin Williams singing Blame Canada, sung at the 2000 Academy Awards. As we talk about Mad Cow USA and where the cow infected with mad cow disease came from, the United States says it was Canada. I'm going to go back to a Wall Street Journal piece of several years ago, April 30th, 2001. Quest for way to spot mad cow disease stirs a scientific squabble in USDA lab. It says one of the scariest things about mad cow disease is that there's no test for it before symptoms appear, either for cattle or people. You can't tell, for instance, if blood used for transfusions is infected. Scientists all over the world are trying to develop a test. 18 months ago, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that one of its researchers in Ames, Iowa, had made a breakthrough that might lead to one, studying a related sheep disease called scrapie. Researcher Mary Jo Schmer developed a potential way to test blood for rogue proteins known as prions, which are believed to cause both scrapie and mad cow. The USDA put out a glowing news release hailing her achievement. Since then, her technique has won a U.S. patent. British government scientists are planning large-scale tests with sheep blood. German government scientists plan to try it with human blood to diagnose Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a brain-wasting malady similar to mad cow. A veterinary unit of American Home Products Corporation is negotiating licensing rights for a range of animal applications. It might seem that Dr. Schmer, a feisty 55-year-old biochemist and ex-nun, would be well along the path to prizes. Instead, she says she is under attack. A researcher with whom she shared information publicly challenged her claims at a recent scientific conference. Rumors circulate in Europe that her process doesn't work. Perhaps most surprisingly, Dr. Schmer accuses superiors within her own organization of obstructing her research by restricting her travel and collaboration with other scientists and even belittling her. Well, today we are joined by the scientist who works with her, who has come up with this test for mad cow disease that the U.S. government won't use, though the British government will. We are joined on the phone right now by Andrew Alpert, president of the biochemistry company PolyLC, based in Maryland. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you take that story forward? That was from 2001. And what exactly you have developed with Dr. Schmer and what your relationship with her is.
Dr. Schmer is still employed at the USDA National Animal Disease Center in Ames, Iowa. Currently, she is has been directed to work on projects other than our assay or its applications. That doesn't mean that the assay is not being used. In fact, the British equivalent of the USDA has already tried it on 20,000 or 30,000 sheep over there, And there are several groups on the European continent that are in the early stages of assessing the test.
Can you explain what the test is?
Yes. One takes a sample of blood, just a regular 10-milliliter vial from the animal in question. And then we, our test involves concentrating this protein that's the expected agent that causes these various diseases, and then uses an antibody against the protein to tell you whether it's there or not. The thing that distinguishes our test from any others out there is, first, other tests require samples where the concentration of this disease-causing protein, the prion, is very high, like brain tissue. Ours just uses blood, which means you can take samples from the same animal over and over again in a relatively non-invasive manner. And the second is that our test is so much more sensitive that we can detect cases of these diseases several years before the animal exhibits clinical symptoms.
So why isn't the U.S. government using it?
Every test has to be validated before it can be approved for use. This is how the federal government regulates just about anything. It has to be assessed and then shown to work before it's approved. The USDA is has decided that our test is uncertain to the degree that they're not going to push forward with it within the agency itself. That said, they did arrange for it to be patented, and the patent has been licensed on an exclusive basis for animal applications, at least, to Fort Dodge Animal Health, which is the largest manufacturer of veterinary test kits in the United States. This was eventually acquired by American Home Products, which is now Wyeth. So at this point, the main factor determining when this would be on the market is presumably the rate of development at the Wyeth facilities at Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Does Britain use the test?
Well, the British equivalent of the USDA tried this test on some 20 to 30,000 samples from sheep. Initially, there were some problems with reproducibility and the like, as with any research project. We worked back and forth with them and overcame the problems, and the last several, the last 10 or 15,000 samples were done with great success and accuracy. At present, they're assessing the data while they decide whether or not to continue on an even larger scale. Prospectively, they could test every sheep in the United Kingdom, and by getting rid of the ones that test positive, theoretically eliminate the disease forever from their flocks, although that's theoretical. No one's ever tried that to find out whether or not that actually works.
We're also joined by John Stauber, who is co-author of the book Mad Cow USA. In today's Christian Science Monitor front page piece, U.S. ponders overhauling beef rules. It says the investigation into the lineage of a Holstein diagnosed with mad cow disease could bring about the greatest changes in the U.S. meat industry since Upton Sinclair's muckraking novel The Jungle led to the creation of the Food and Drug Administration nearly a half century ago. In the wake of the discovery of the diseased animal, statements from Capitol Hill, the Department of Agriculture, and scientific and industry experts point to a spate of new regulations that could appear over the next year. Could you comment on where you think the industry needs to go, what they need to do, and also on the significance of this test that that Andrew Alpert is talking about?
Sure, Amy, I'd be happy to. First of all, regarding the test, I've been saying for years and years that we need to have a tremendous advance in testing of humans and animals, a test that would find the prion agent in blood and could do it reliably would be incredibly important. And this isn't just an animal health issue, obviously. Last week, the science journal Nature and other publications reported on what Britain suspects is the first case of human mad cow disease that was spread through a blood transfusion. Britain doesn't use its own human blood anymore. It imports human blood because in Britain, people who were exposed to or even died from human mad cow disease gave blood. And right now, there's no effective way to screen the blood supply. Already, the government of Australia is considering banning blood donations from people in the U.S. because of the mad cow outbreak here and the possibility of contaminated human blood. So this is an area, blood testing, that we really need to step up, and we really need to push the development of tests. Unfortunately, here in the United States, in my opinion, the animal testing program has been designed not to find mad cow disease. In the last 9 years, there have been something like 300 million U.S. cattle slaughtered. And over the last 9 years, there have been something like 30,000 cattle tested for mad cow disease. So the testing program for cattle is completely inadequate. Now, your second question, Amy, was on changes that might come about here in the United States because of the discovery of mad cow disease. I think this is what we all hope, that finally now, a decade and a half too late, but better late than never, the United States will take this threat seriously and will implement the changes that have already been put in place and are working so effectively in Britain, in Europe, and Japan. And those changes would primarily be two. One, we would completely ban the feeding of rendered byproducts, slaughterhouse waste, back to animals. Now, a lot of people think we did that in 1997 because they keep hearing the Cattlemen's Beef Association and the USDA and all their related experts talking about the feed ban, the feed ban. The feed ban was a joke. We shouldn't even refer to the 97 FDA regulations as a feed ban. They were just really a labeling requirement that cattle, meat, and bone meal be labeled do not feed to ruminants. But blood, for instance, was exempted from that requirement. So today there is an ocean of cattle blood in North America that's processed into cattle feed and fed back to cattle, even though blood can transmit mad cow-type diseases in laboratory tests. And as we've been discussing, because of the risks of blood transmission, Britain doesn't even use its own human blood. And yet, here in the United States, we are weaning calves on milk formula containing products like raw cattle blood plasma. This is the biggest change we have to make, and we should be making it immediately, but I suspect that the United States will not impose a total feed ban because it would cost money to the livestock industry. Along with that feed ban, of course, would have to go extensive testing of cattle. And we don't have to wait for this new test to extensively test cattle. Europe is testing millions of cows. Japan is testing every cow before slaughter. We could immediately use existing tests, the so-called quick tests, and begin testing millions of cattle. That's absolutely what we have to do. I'm happy to hear about the optimism in that Christian Science Monitor article, but I have to tell you, I'm not optimistic because we've seen how the corporate and government regime here in the United States is so expert at using crisis management public relations techniques to quell public debate and concern and to drag things out and to make rhetorical promises of reform and let the whole thing die down in the press, and nothing happens. You know, we can just look at the massive corporate economic scandals over the last few years that keep going on and on, including the most recent mutual fund scandal. We get all sorts of politicians and regulators assuring the public that changes will be made. They implement a public relations campaign to deluge us with misleading claims in the media. The media eventually moves on to other issues, and no fundamental reform happens. That's the same game that the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and their PR advisor, Burson Marsteller, and the USDA are playing right now.
Mm. It's interesting when you look at the numbers. In 1997, 219 cows in the United States were tested. Then, because of complaints, that number increased to more than 20,000 last year. While that number may sound like a lot, you compare it to Europe, which tests 10 million cows every year, and Japan inspects 1.2 million cows annually.
That's absolutely right. And again, we hear candidates like Howard Dean saying, gee, maybe it's time to bail out the meat industry, and gee, we should have traceability. But what we're not hearing, candidates or officials or anyone in the Bush administration or the livestock industry is saying, gee, we made a huge blunder. We should follow the lead of our European trade partners and implement the total ban on feeding slaughterhouse waste and do extensive testing. I mean, this really is rather simple. All we have to do is ship Ann Veneman and six of her smartest advisors off on a little tour to the UK, Europe, and Japan. They can come back in a week, and they can implement exactly the type of systems that are in place in those countries. Right now, we're feeding billions of pounds of slaughtered animal waste back to animals, and yet what we're hearing out of USDA is, oh, we had a firewall feed ban put in place in 97, and gee, guess what? This animal we think may have come from Canada, and it may have been born before those firewall feed bans took effect. This is mythology. These are lies. This is deception. The situation here in the United States is we're weaning calves on cattle blood, we're grinding up slaughtered cattle parts, feeding them to pigs and chickens, grinding them up, feeding them back to cattle. Chickens are eating rendered cattle and pooping it out in their litter. The litter is scooped up legally and fed back to cattle. There are so many routes of transmission. Even if the 1997 labeling requirements, and all they said was ruminant meat and bone meal should be labeled, do not feed to ruminants, even if there had been 100% compliance with that regulation instead of the massive disregard that has taken place in the feed industry, once a bag of rendered byproduct is purchased by a farmer or a producer, it can be fed to any animal. We've got to just shut down this practice, and right now what we're seeing is a concerted public relations and no doubt a lobby campaign to make sure that the systems that are working so well in Britain and Europe and Japan are not instituted here. Why? Because it would cost the massive, politically powerful livestock industry some money.
Are you concerned about Dr. Kenneth Peterson's comments of the USDA's Food and Safety Inspection Service, who said no additional inspections have been ordered and meat from cows that were too sick or injured to stand or walk unassisted would continue to be allowed to be sold for human consumption, provided there is no evidence of neurological problems?
It's stunning. It's just stunning. That, fortunately, is one of the more honest statements I've heard out of USDA, and I hope people are listening to it. I think part of the problem here, Amy, is that we have a food system that every year kills at least 5,000 Americans. 5,000 people die a year from contaminated food in the United States. And I think what has happened since the public has been led to accept that level of risk in our food supply is that there's a horrible callousness that develops in these government regulators and in the livestock and food industry. And they look at this and they go, gee, you know, we're killing 5,000 people a year through contaminated food in the United States. How big a problem can this be? We can get the public to accept the shoddy, failing inspection system and the feces-contaminated meat that we're selling them now. Let's just apply some more PR to this, and this problem can be solved too.
John Stauber, I want to thank you for being with us, co-author of Mad Cow USA. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Run,
to a shelter, run to a friend. Run for my life before it comes to an end. Run to a shelter, run to a friend. Run for my life before it comes to an end. I am gonna run.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Los Angeles Times is reporting today a Syrian firm with ties to Syria's president signed contracts to supply millions of dollars in arms and equipment to Iraq before the U.S. invasion. The company SES International was headed by a cousin of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. The firm reportedly sold Iraq 1,000 heavy machine guns and up to 20 million bullets for assault rifles. The Los Angeles Times also found a Polish company sent nearly 400 surface-to-air missile engines to Baghdad through Syria. A South Korea firm shipped $8 million in telecommunications equipment. Well, today we're going to turn to another story in Iraq that has received very little attention, and that is the role of women during this occupation. We recently spoke to Yonar Mohammed here in our Firehouse studios, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, a group that works to stop atrocities against Iraqi women and defend their rights. The group is starting a battered women's shelter in Baghdad to protect women. She also serves as editor-in-chief of the newspaper Al-Masawat, which stands for equality. Today we bring you just the first excerpt of this interview.
The story that does not reach to this part of the world is how the women are treated in the post-war Iraq, what happened to us, how our, let's say, destinies were totally devastated by this war. What is told to everybody is that we got rid of a bloody dictator, which is a true story. But the part that nobody knows about is that we did have sort of a secure life. We did have our jobs. We did have some stability that we totally lost with the first day of the war. Now, our everyday life has abductions for women. We cannot go out in the streets safely. We are immediately a moving target on the streets, and we qualify for kidnappings, for rape and for killing just because we are women. And on top of all of that, what the coalition did was hand over part of the authorities to religious fundamentalists that turned our lives to push us hundreds of years back in time. We are pushed back to the spot where my grandmother was, and that's not where we want to be. Women in Iraq have been educated. They've had access to work for more than half a century now. It's something that we will not do without anymore. They go into our schools now. They force the women into veil, and you look at the streets. The women are not safe to be out in the streets. This is our reality in the post-war Iraq, and these are the freedoms and the democracy that we testify now in Baghdad.
What kind of participation do you have in any kind of governance?
I try to be part of the women conferences that the coalition supervised, and they said that they want to make the voices of the Iraqi women heard. But I was surprised that because I was having demands of equality between women and men, of a constitution that becomes secular, that is based on this equality, I was rejected in this conference. When I went to the coalition asking for support for women's organizations, for a first women's shelter in Baghdad, I reminded them of their responsibilities to keep the securities for women on the streets. I had very set demands, and all I found was deaf ears, nobody who was willing to respond in any way. And for the financial support, they told me, you can go talk to NGOs. When I reminded them that this is more than half the Iraqi population I'm talking about, and the resources should be directed to us before anywhere else, I was told, these are the emails of the NGOs. You can talk to them. They are very good in that.
And who is they who told you this?
I met top officials. One of them was Stephen Spears. He was the first consultant for the future Ministry of Social Affairs, Labor and Social Affairs. And he was supposed to be responsible for whatever programs are for women. And I did ask him, I told him, look, if you claim that you are bringing us democracy to Iraq, American democracy, how about you give us some of the democracy that was gained by the working class of America, the achievements that they had here, the feminists, what they got in America. For example, the social insurance, the benefits, that's what we need in Baghdad and in Iraq right now, especially because this war had made millions of people jobless, and they have no source of income. And let's talk about the hundreds of thousands of widows who have children and no source of income. How are they supposed to survive one more day after 13 years of sanctions and two of the most fierce wars? They need, let's say, a minimum of an emergency fee right away to be able to survive. He looked at me and he made a presentation of how tired he was because he's left his family back home and how much efforts he was putting into setting up a government that could take some time. After setting up the government, they'll make a census from north to south in Iraq, and then they will decide who to give the benefits and the social insurance to. Then he looked at me and he said, did you have social insurance in Saddam's times? And that was a surprise for me. I told him, are you trying to equal Saddam's, the Ba'ath regime times for us? Is that what we're trying to do here? And he was pissed off with the whole thing that I was asking for. And his final announcement was, are you here to collaborate or to confront? So, you know, us women's groups in Iraq, people would think that all the world is looking at us and everybody wants to help. But I knocked all doors in order to get help, and I did not get any.
Yanar Mohammed speaking to us in our Firehouse Studios, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. And that does it for today's program. We'll play the second part of that interview in the coming days. Democracy Now! Is a collaboration of producers and volunteers. We have so many to thank who helped us move into our new studios on the first floor of Downtown Community Television. We want to thank everyone who helped. Alexandra Castillo and Hector Caruso and Victor Reyes and Jason Woodbury, Richard Martin, Ron Neal, Paul Forzensky and Stephen Marks and Matt from the Catholic Worker and Leisha Markinson and Javon and Mike Simpson and Dina Barbara, Joan Costa, Chris Esteen and Marco, Nick Wheeler, Neil Benzel, Vladislav and Annie Gallo, Russell Branca and Gustavo and Marie and Moret and Klebert and Justin Green, Cheryl, so many people helped to make this possible. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Radiation underground and in the